Hello and welcome to a new season of Dr. Meet KI, a collaborative learning initiative between the AI Campus and the Charité Universitätsmedizin Berlin. My name is Marina Lex and I'm a PhD student in Professor Dr. Kerstin Ritter's research group at Charité. We are back with Professor Ozanan Mareles. Last episode we talked about real-time computer vision during surgery with him. In today's episode, we will explore whether robots could realistically serve as future surgeons. Additionally, we will delve into the potential and challenges of integrating AI into surgical practices. So speaking of the future, potentially information such as real-time information generated by AI models could be provided to surgeons by augmented reality. Is that fiction or something you can find already in high-tech operation rooms?
I don't think, I mean, everything once upon a time was science fiction, right? If you think about it. Like, if, I remember, like, I'm way older than you, but I remember, like, when I was a kid, they took us to, called Telefonica, which was one of the operators from the telecoms in Brazil. And we just like browse through the history of the telephone, which I think is actually one of the coolest ever stories told from Alexander Graham Bell since from the beginning. But we ended up being at the very end of this museum where we're standing probably, I don't know, several meters, maybe 100 meters distance between each other. And there was a monitor that you could speak to the screen, you know, and there was like a video call. And now this is so normal, you know, and then with COVID also made telemedicine super normal. Like right now, what we're doing is, I could not think that was science fiction today, but it was science fiction in the past. So we have, like, for example, already some technology that are done by computation resources and augmentation, not necessarily to be called AI, because if you think about it, there is a lot of narrow AI that we use, you know, all the time. That they do those things already. There is some. It was a very elegant work coming from Strasbourg, from the ARCAD Center in France. That they do have some overlaying of how the liver would look like laparoscopically with the CT scanner, and. Not just, and that actually also deforms and changes when you insufflate the lumpur and you remove the liver. And many other companies are working on that as well. So I personally don't find to be that special at the moment. But as technology evolves, as the AI models are evolving, as we're getting close to much more sophisticated generative AI and eventually like some AGI, I could totally see that the machine could start extrapolating the knowledge from expert surgeons and expert radiologists and merging them and helping us to create, superimpose, like, you know, meshes of image inside the abdomen and tell us where to go and what to do. So I don't find that to be science fiction. And the time for this will come soon.
Yeah, so my next question might even sound more science fiction, but how about AI-driven robots in surgery? Is that something we are going to see in the near future?
Yeah, people love that question. I think, I don't know, somehow people love robots, right? We see those cars now, you know, self-driving cars, and that's also, if you go back 10 years ago, that was science fiction, right? Now it's becoming more of a reality. It always goes about regulations, right? Because healthcare is like the most regulated, area that we have in general doing business for companies, for reasons, because we have people's lives in our hands. So just like creating like a self-driving car and somebody buys in, there was a crash and accident, you know, it is regulated. But getting a robot, that a robot's going to go rogue and going to do something, and then who are you going to blame? You're going to blame the manufacturer of the robot or the surgeon, right? So I think this is going to be a very, how can I say, sensitive subject to be undertaken. But taking that aside, this disclosure, many things are possible already. We have some experimental robots that they can actually suture perfectly, right? That was called the STAR robot. We had some very good experiments from roboticists, like UC Berkeley, Ken Goldberg, that he was able to use computer vision to get the Da Vinci robot to do tasks of the FLS, with the fundamentals of laparoscopic surgery. That's one of the things that SAGE has created, and the American Board of Surgeons mandate that you have to be certified before graduating. So everything is possible. But at the same time, on some experiments, when they go wrong badly. You know, the robot, instead of cutting what's supposed to cut the entire circle, similarly for the self-driving cars, they may be crashing stationary objects. So I think full autonomous robots, and that's my personal opinion, I don't think you're going to be seeing in our lifetime, at least in our professional lifetime. But we're going to be seeing a lot of sub-task automation. Like the robot's going to be able to drive the camera following you. You know, the robot's going to be able to do some retraction for you. Of course, like you overseeing that, going to be able to do a portion of the operation. For example, you put the two parts of the small bowel, the intestine together, and you just like draw suture from here to there. And then like a sewing machine will go ahead and going to close that. But like let a robot to make the judgment about what to do next. And I think we won't see that.
I see. Thank you so much for that insight. So let's shift the focus from specific applications of AI in surgery to explore the broader impact of AI in healthcare as a whole. For example, one of the research visions of the Sales Lab includes democratizing surgical knowledge with AI. What problem does this vision address, and how can AI help to overcome it?
Yeah, of course, go back to what I was explaining in the beginning, right? That the biggest gap that we find, through healthcare is not the lack of technical skills, right? To the point, if you think about it, I don't know how it's in Germany, but in the US, you have some people that just call them technicians or technologists, you know, because we teach them with the technical skills. So some people could actually do a small procedure, could assist the surgeon during surgery, you know, we'll do the ultrasound for the radiologist, right? Because teaching technical skills is much easier than teaching cognitive knowledge. So then if we do this, for example, if you take, let's say, a PA, the number of years in school is much less than an MD, right? So that being said, once you have those medical doctors, could be a surgeon, could be a general practitioner, clinician, a primary care physician, an emergency department doctor, they do have their knowledge of their domain. But they don't have this holistic expertise because we just don't have enough brain power to know everything, right? So then what happened is one of the biggest problems we have in the US, and I don't know how it's in Europe, is like transfer, right? Or you go to your primary care physician and said, oh, you have this problem, but I don't treat them, so I'm going to refer you to four people, right? And then you get to those people, and then they'll say, okay, perfect. So now you are going to joke about this. I'm a right-hand specialist orthopedics. I don't treat left hands, right? As a joke. So it's being facetious. They're going to send you to see somebody who specializes on the left hand. And what happens is this drives the cost of healthcare exponentially, plus the time to take care of those patients, right? So ideally, if you go to, let's say, a primary care physician and say, oh, you have diabetes, you have high blood pressure, you have sleep apnea. And then if there is a cognitive knowledge, such as the computational consciousness, right, telling you, oh, that's how the best way to treat this. That's how the best way to do that. That's the best way to do that. And then the clinician agrees with this, then you're already taking care of the patient, right? And of course, if something gets like out of hand, then it goes to the specialist. Similarly for surgery, right? If there is a surgeon in a rural area or the military zones and things like that, that's not specialized on that particular procedure, but has the technical skills, it can be guided by the machine by the means of cognitive augmentation. So that's how we would believe would be by democratizing the knowledge will lead to lowering cost. It will lead to better patient care. And we will lead to overall physician experience.
Another impact of AI in healthcare can definitely be reduction of costs by increasing healthcare efficiency. Can we see AI help to cut healthcare costs already?
Oh, for sure. It's just a matter of implementing this. For example, we spend about 30% of our time documenting, especially in electronic medical records. And much of those are one of the biggest frustrations of clinicians. So, for example, using AIs for summarization of the encounter, using AI to generate the billing, AI to generate the next steps, of the patient care, creating chat bots that can be trained to interact with the patients for basic needs and trigger to call a clinician when needed. Those are what you're going to start seeing very soon. Here at Duke, we are doing a lot of evaluation of those tools. And slowly we're integrating into the clinician's practice. So like any new technology being introduced, you're going to see first being hard to utilize, hard to understand. You may see it's about declining productivity because you are introducing the new technology. But after that, you're going to be seeing the productivity going to get better. The biggest question would be what to do with the extra time that you're saving for the clinicians, right? Are you going to make them see more patients or you're going to make them spend more time with the patients, right? So that's the conundrum that people are going to be facing.
I see. What do you think about that conundrum? So, for example, the hospital might be interested to getting more revenues and that you see more patients. What do you feel about that statement?
I think we are all adults, right? And we all have our preferences and choices, right? The hospitals, it has a point that they cannot and should not be forcing this into the clinicians, right? They should just give them the option, right? Create a compensation structure that's transparent enough and say, you have more time and you keep the same salary because you're doing the same productivity, which is great. Or we are cutting some costs, we're not utilizing resources that we should. And so we're going to be sharing some of the profits. Or just tell them, if you have extra time, I have some extra shifts or you only can do extra surgeries and then you can make more money. So I think some people are going to go for the quality of life. Others are going to go for the, increasing revenue. And it may oscillate depending on the people's necessity. But I think this is also something that it should be on a table to be discussed as AI is introduced into the healthcare sector to see how does this going to be benefiting both parties, the healthcare providers and the administrative people who run those businesses.
I would like to shift our conversation now to the key challenges, keywords, and areas to approach with caution when working with AI. So in Germany, we face a big data privacy problem because when using AI tools, we don't know where the data goes, who is training with it, where sensible patient information goes. In the US, regulations for AI in medicine are known to be less strict compared to Germany. Do you think this more lenient regulatory environment is beneficial for fostering innovation and growth in AI applications within medicine?
Well, it's hard to say because, for example, when you say the U.S. and the majority of the states in the United States, because California has its own, and California is more strict than GDPR, right, and in Europe. And we don't know which way we're going to go, if we are going to go the California way or if California going to be the only one. I think the restrictions are there for one reason is because people fear something. And also a lot of times fear comes from a lack of education and knowledge, right? So the politicians, the regulators, the first thing to do is just I don't know much about this, but there is a potential harm. So let's just prohibit it, right? What I think what's going to happen is there are countries that are less restricted than the United States as well. As we see those technologies being developed and utilized, and then we can prove that, we will find out that actually does really incurring data privacy breaches or not, and how much, that's gonna be our thermometer to our gauge where to go, right? So it's hard to say if Europe's correct or if the US is correct, just time gonna tell us. But at the same time, as the regulators are becoming better educated and who are educating them, we should be educating them, the community. They may, change, they may do a pilot, they do something like that. But a bigger challenge than that that I see is not even for the data privacy point, because this is like a, it's easy, right? I'm afraid that the data going to be breached and therefore going to be potential hurdles, including lawsuits and, you know, so on and so forth. Therefore, we're just going to put those policies. What I'm concerned is that when AI applications are being put into practice, it will be how knowledgeable are the people using them? Because the AI is just a tool like anything else. If you don't know how to use properly, so then the outcome's not going to be ideal. You know, it's the same thing. Like if I give you like a Formula One car, and you don't know how to drive it, it cannot be that fast, right? It cannot be that safe. So I think, my concern and also advice would be that the concern is that people might start using them without knowing how to use them. And they may become like, over dependent on the technology, or they can become overly critical to the technology, right? So my recommendation is that people should be educated and trained to use those devices, you know, and you should also be certified to use a high impact artificial general intelligence in medicine. So it should be almost like see as your partner that you can trust, but also you can challenge.
I have two small questions for the end. So one question is, which AI tool benefits you the most for your daily life?
To be really honest with you, is the ChatGPT, because I created a few fine-tuned models, and they increase operational efficiency extremely, extremely high. I really, really like it a lot. The second one, I would say I love Grammarly. That helps, you know, and especially like if you're going to write something, I speak Portuguese and English, but if you're going to write in another language that you have not used for a while, especially Portuguese is so hard with, all those accents and conjugations. It's not as hard as German, but more complex than English. It helps a lot, you know. In a third one that for my personal use, because my hobby, I love music, it's called Suno. That helps you to create, AI music productions.
I know it. It's great. And to wrap up on a positive note, what excites you the most about the future of AI?
It is right now the fact that everybody's so excited about it. So everybody's very, like the majority of people are positive about it, right? So they want to see something. Because if you go back in 2017, 2018, people had no idea what it is, have to explain. Was hard to get funding, was hard to get grants, was hard to have collaborators. Now, there is just like a large amount of people and resources available, which is like mind-blowing, right? So this excites me the most because it makes us, especially academicians and researchers, like with a lot of work to do.
Yeah, thank you so much for meeting with me. I was honored to speak with you, and thank you for being in the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And danke schön.